Welcome to Power Play. Thanks for watching. I'm Evan Solomon. On the program today, vaccine confusion and damage control.
mRNA vaccines are the preferred vaccine.
It basically depends on where you are. So if you are in an area where there's no COVID, then waiting for your mRNA is okay.
So after the National Advisory Committee on Immunization spread some confusion about when Canadians should take the AstraZeneca and Johnson vaccine, should Canadians really wait for a vaccine in the midst of the third wave of the pandemic? Today, the Prime Minister appeared to go into vaccine damage control. Check this out.
All vaccines in Canada have been approved by Health Canada. Our advice to provinces and territories and to Canadians has not changed. Make sure you get your shot as soon as it's your turn.
Okay, that's a very different picture. So how should Canadians make sense of the seemingly conflicting messages? Should there be only one voice on vaccine protocol? Is the first vaccine you get really the best, or should you wait? We're going to break it down with CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abhi Sharkawi and Dr. Isaac Bogosh, who sits on the Ontario COVID-19 Vaccine Task Force. They are standing by. Then, the Vance controversy. Who should finally be held accountable?
Attacking, who's to blame, making one person resign, that's not going to fix the situation for women. It's the Prime Minister that's to blame, and it's the Defense Minister that's to blame. That's the person who's responsible, and then that's where the responsibility and the accountability should stand.
Who is finally accountable for not following up on a complaint of improper sexual behavior made against Canada's former top general, Jonathan Vance, an allegation he denies? Will the NDP support a Conservative call to fire Katie Telford, Justin Trudeau's chief of staff? We're going to ask NDP leader Jagmeet Singh to outline what he views as the solution here. Plus, new restrictions coming to Alberta just after our program tonight. Check this out.
We've always taken the approach that restrictions should be a last and limited resort to maximize compliance and public buy-in. Clearly, what's happening right now cannot continue.
Okay, so Premier Jason Kenney warns that tough new restrictions are coming to protect hospitals in Canada's and the North America's COVID hotspot. Will it make a difference? But is it too little, too late after countless flip-flops from the Premier? We're going to ask the mayor of the region in the eye of the COVID storm, Don Scott, of Wood Buffalo. That's where Fort McMurray is located. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
And the question is really to say this needs to be an informed consent. If, for instance, my sister was to get the AstraZeneca vaccine and die of a thrombosis, when I know that it could have been prevented and that she's not in a high-risk area, I'm not sure I could live with it.
Okay, that clip has gone viral. It was on our program last night. More than 250,000 Canadians have now seen it just on Twitter alone, undercutting Canada's message on vaccines. Again, that's Dr. Carolyn Quash. She's the chair of the National Advisory Committee on Immunization on this program yesterday, telling us that if the risk isn't there, if you're not in a high-risk area and you can decide that, then maybe Canadians should just wait until an mRNA vaccine like Pfizer or Moderna becomes available. Now, I know today there's going to be 3 million vaccines, 2 million Pfizer and 1 million Moderna finally showing up this week and 2 million Pfizer next week. But the fallout from that interview forced the Prime Minister and the federal health officials like Dr. Theresa Tam today to reiterate, no, the safety of the viral vector vaccines, AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, are unparalleled. Here's what they said.
Every single vaccine available in Canada has been approved by Health Canada as being both safe and effective. It is a good thing that we get to hear from a broad range of medical experts and doctors making recommendations to keep us safe. The bottom line is we need to all of us get vaccinated as quickly as possible so we can get back to normal.
Okay, so the Prime Minister saying the best vaccine is the first vaccine, which is the old message. NACI saying, well, hang on, there's real concerns about thrombosis or blood clots. Maybe if you can and you think you should, maybe you should wait. Is that confusing the message and damaging the rollout here, especially for the 1.5 million people who have already taken AstraZeneca? Will that make them hesitate to take a second shot? Let's bring this to some doctors, epidemiologists, and Dr. Abdu Sharkawi, of course, is our CTV News infectious disease specialist, and Dr. Isaac Bogosh is a member of the Ontario COVID-19 Vaccine Distribution Task Force. Docs, thank you for your frontline work, and I appreciate it. I'll start with you, Dr. Sharkawi. You saw Dr. Quash on this program last night use that example. You know, if my sister got AstraZeneca and she died and I'd recommended it, I couldn't live with myself, so maybe I wouldn't if she can get later, a week or two later, the Pfizer. What do you make of that message coming from NACI?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. I think that NACI had very good intentions, and those were to try and be as transparent as possible to ensure that they were being honest with Canadians. And while that may be the case, the problem is that we're dealing with a context of a vaccine that has been very much maligned with bad communication and a lack of transparency on the part of AstraZeneca itself. And that has really undermined the really important benefits that this vaccine has had in terms of its effectiveness in the real world, especially in the UK, where the B.1.1.7 variant is originating from and is problematic. So I think that the problem was that this nuance, which is important, was maybe highlighted a little bit too much to the detriment of public trust, which has already been eroded quite significantly with the baggage that comes with this vaccine from the past 2 months. And that's what I think caused a lot of people to cringe and maybe for jaws to open wide, thinking that's probably not the message that we want most people to hear, and certainly not the one that we want them to listen to the exclusion of the important benefits within the third wave in many parts of this country that are still struggling with a vaccine supply. And we are in a race against time.
Yeah, Dr. Bogosh, this notion of preferred vaccines. Look, it's not that the science is wrong. There's legitimate concerns about thrombosis, these blood clots. But was that an effective way to communicate the risks of the potential side effects from AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson versus the horrific third wave sweeping over the country and sweeping over places that thought they were clear? What did you make of all that messaging?
Yeah, I see your point and I share your sentiment. I think that at the end of the day, you have to really communicate four things effectively. What is the benefit of the vaccine? Obviously, protection of yourself, but also protection of those around you. What are the drawbacks of the vaccine? Okay, it's the rare but not 0% risk of these blood clots, which can be severe, but of course we know they're rare. What are the alternatives, which is don't get a vaccine or wait for a vaccine where in that time you can get COVID? And what is the context? And the context, as Dr. Sharkawi points out, we're in the midst of a huge third wave. We've never had this much COVID in Canada than ever before. We're all sitting in Ontario right now where, you know, you've got tents set up in front of some hospitals. We've got adults admitted to the pediatric ICU. We've got healthcare providers from Newfoundland that are coming in to help us out. And surgeries are canceled all over the province so we can care for our influx of COVID-19. Here is a vaccine that can truly save your life. You know, at least inform people and enable people to make an informed decision. You know, and you have to talk about risk, benefits, alternative, and context. And that really will help enable people to make an informed choice. And I think many, in fact, most will choose to take the vaccine, which, again, I've been promoting. I think that's how we get to the answer. Take the first one that's available. It's through that thought process of going through risk, benefits, alternatives, and context. That's what lands you at take the first vaccine.
Yeah, but that's not what they said, Dr. Sharkawi. They said, you know, take the first vaccine unless you're in a low area. Who determines that? And these aren't the preferred vaccines. Do you think this is going to contribute to hesitancy? Maybe people who got the AstraZeneca now don't want, they got the first shot, they don't want the second shot, or 1.5 million Canadians now scared to do that. What do you make of all that? And what should the fix be, Dr. Sharkawi?
Well, as I said, I think it was problematic in terms of how it was framed. There's lots of issues that have already played out in terms of a lack of trust with respect to this sort of messaging and this vaccine in particular. And I think we have to recognize that there are consequences when you make a statement that suggests that one set of vaccines are preferred. And conversely, by default, that means another set of vaccines are not preferred. They're potentially harmful if you want to take that narrative and run with it. And I think there's two really important nuances that probably didn't come up when we talk about who's at risk here. Don't forget that you can go from a situation where you don't have a lot of circulating activity within your community to one in which there's a lot of activity, and that can happen in a very short period of time. Are you going to take that risk while waiting? The other problem relates to equity. You know, the supposition here was that if you are able to live at home, work from home, subsist fairly comfortably from home, this is an alternative that may be best for you. Well, guess what? There's a lot of people who don't have that choice, especially essential workers who we know and we've documented repeatedly have been disproportionately impacted by this third wave. Those are the people filling up our ICUs and dying. Is it fair to say that they should be receiving a product that maybe isn't the preferred product, while others who perhaps are more privileged and have other resources have the luxury of making another choice? That's a really problematic issue to play out. And I don't think that that's something that we want to have Canadians believe is what our recommendations are.
I should say, people look at the UK, they were dragged out of the pandemic by AstraZeneca, right? It seemed to be good enough for them. Over 120 million people have had AstraZeneca. Dr. Bogosh, what's the fix here? Because you got the Prime Minister and public health saying these are all safe vaccines. You got NACI saying they're safe with an asterisk unless you don't feel it's safe, and then you should maybe wait for the preferred vaccine. What is the fix? Do we need a single voice here to avoid hesitancy, fear, just one source as opposed to two conflicting sources?
Evan, I truly don't know the answer to that. I truly don't know. I mean, it's helpful to have lots of experts weigh in. It's also helpful to have diversity of thought and diversity of opinion. But clearly, we have an issue where we are now, as Dr. Sharkawi pointed out, in a position where we're eroding trust in some of our institutions and in some of the vaccines. I mean, vaccination is our way out of this pandemic. We have to get as many Canadians vaccinated as quickly as possible. Any step towards speeding up the vaccine process, ensuring it's done in an equitable manner, getting access to more vaccines, using the vaccines we have in a smart way, like that's clearly the right direction. I mean, I think we can improve our communication. I think we can improve our community engagement. I think we can enable people to make good decisions and smart decisions. But operationalizing that is going to be challenging.
I got about 10 seconds here, just real quick. I'll just go to you, Dr. Bogosh, just real quick. I know there's a study in the UK about mixing and matching, right? That if you had the AstraZeneca as your first dose, the viral vector, your second dose may be, you might get a Pfizer or a Moderna. It's okay to mix. Is that a decision that NACI might have to come to soon as well, Dr. Bogosh? You think that's coming?
Yeah, they're going to be opining on this probably in the middle of the month. No one has a crystal ball, but like, just pure speculation here, it's very likely that that's going to be a safe and effective approach. It's very likely that people who had a first dose of vaccine A will get a second dose of vaccine B. But again, let's wait for the data before we conclude that. It's likely going to happen.
Right. And because we're getting a lot of Pfizer and Moderna, so we'll find out. When Dr. Bogosh and Dr. Sharkawi, the two of you have been incredibly helpful in balancing the communication with the frontline work you do. Thanks, gents. Always appreciate it.
Have a good one.
Thank you.
All right. Should the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff resign? Let's flip over to a political issue outside of the pandemic. Look, the Conservatives are saying yes. They're calling for Katie Telford to be ousted from the Prime Minister's office over a 2018 allegation against Canada's former top soldier, General Jonathan Vance. They say the complaint against him was not followed up. They allege that after the then military ombudsman, Gary Welborn, said that he told the defense minister, Sajjan, about a complaint of inappropriate sexual behavior against the then chief of the defense staff, General Vance. By the way, he denies that allegation. They believe that Sajjan conveyed the complaint to others in the prime minister's office, including eventually to Katie Telford. The prime minister denies he or anyone in his office knew the nature of the allegations, the Me Too nature. But the NDP says Katie Telford shouldn't be the one who's accountable. It's the prime minister. How would that happen? I'm going to bring in Jagmeet Singh, the NDP leader, on this and some other issues. Mr. Singh, always good to have you on the program. Who then is accountable. The conservatives are saying Katie Telford, either she should resign or at least be dragged before the defense committee. What's your take on this?
Who's responsible at the end of the day for keeping Canadians safe, for keeping women who are serving in the Canadian forces safe, is the prime minister. At the end of the day, the buck stops with the prime minister. And at the end of the day, the defense minister also is responsible. But for me, I ask this question directly. What is the goal that the conservatives want? What is the goal that the liberals want to achieve? Because to me, neither the liberals attempt to have a second inquiry, nor the conservatives attempt to blame or find out who's most responsible is going to make women any safer. Neither of them actually care about making women right now safer in the Canadian Armed Forces. What we're saying is, why don't we put all our effort into actually implementing what the Deschamps report said that we should do back in 2015? Let's put those recommendations in place and actually protect women. That should be the goal here. The conservatives are out to lunch. They're just, again, missing the plot. They're not getting that the goal here should be to make women safer. That's the goal.
Yeah, but just to be fair, I know you had said it would be ironic if a woman loses her job over the alleged actions of a man in this Me Too. But the Conservative Party deputy leader, Candace Bergen, has said your party stance on Katie Telford isn't right, and that she said women of power should not should be held to the same account as men in positions, and saying that they shouldn't be. She accused you of being patronizing and sexist. What's your response?
That what is the goal of the Conservative Party right now? Like, do they actually want to make women safer in the military? Do they actually want to see a resolution to this? No, that is not their goal. Their goal is they're out for blood. They want to attack without any goal. Our goal is very specific. The prime minister is in charge.
I just want to push back. Like, I don't know what their goal is
to make sure women are safer. Well, they should but put isn't in their place goal changes just, to make sure like, there's independence.
I don't want to get all Augustinian on this because I don't know what's in people's heart and their motive, but isn't politically what they want accountability of some sort? Because I know the government's position is everyone did the right thing, but the system is bad. So now we've got not only the 2015 Deschamps report, which they didn't do anything to, as you've talked about, but they've got this new Louise Arbour study coming. And they said, we're going to fix the system because the system didn't allow us to do anything. That's their position, I guess. In your view, who then is ultimately accountable? Are you calling for the defense minister to resign because of this?
The responsibility lies with the prime minister. The prime minister is the one who calls the shots. The prime minister has that report, 2015 report. The prime minister has all the evidence in front of him now. Whether he knew it before, I think he did. Doesn't matter. Right now, the point is, do you want to make sure women are safer? Because right now, the message that's been sent to women is that if you raise a complaint, a legitimate complaint, and it makes it to the highest office of the land, guess what? Nothing happens. No one listens to you and no actions are taken. That is a horrible message. That is what needs to be fixed. That's where the attention should be. And we're saying the responsibility for action in this country when it comes to our military is, of course, the prime minister's responsibility. It is without a doubt the prime minister of Canada who's got the responsibility to make sure women are safe in the Canadian Armed Forces. And that's where the buck ends. That's where the buck stops. That's what we're calling for.
Okay, just two things before I let you go. I know this legislation that is going to redo and overhaul the Broadcasting Act has been subjected to an enormous amount of controversy. We've covered it a lot on this program, and we will continue to do so later in this program. Now we're hearing that there may be some amendment that the Liberals are going to bring forward to ensure Canadians that their user-generated content, their YouTube or their Instagram or their Spotify, is not going to be regulated by the CRTC. You had originally supported this bill before, even without that exemption. Do you think it's necessary to do that? Or does your party stand by the position they don't need a new amendment to ensure Canadians that their social media is safe?
Well, we need to make sure this is abundantly clear because people are worried. And it's important to make sure there is no doubt in anyone's mind that there will be any infringement on people's ability to post what they want, to critique the government if they want, to raise concerns, and to do what they want, of course, within the limit of hate speech, but to be able to express themselves freely on the internet. It's vital. Evan, I use my social media a lot. I think it's really important that there's freedom there. And really what this speaks to is the bill was supposed to be about not letting foreign companies have an exemption when it comes to Canadian laws. Because right now, if you're a Canadian company, you've got to follow the laws. But if you're a foreign company, right. you get basically a free ride. No laws apply to you.
Right.
So that was the goal, which makes sense. Of course, we want the same laws to apply to our foreign broadcasters as well as to local. It does makes no sense that it wasn't a level playing field.
I know, but your party had defended the legislation as being good enough, and now there's going to be an exemption. I'm just okay.
So basically, mismanaged the file. It's an important idea to create a level playing field between Canadian broadcasters and foreign broadcasters.
Right.
They've messed up the file and created this doubt and confusion. They need to fix it. We need to make sure that there's no infringement on.
I know, but you say they messed it up, but you guys were supporting it before. So I'm just trying. We'll find out what the amendment is, and then we'll have a good debate. Unfortunately, Mr. Singh, I want to go to Regina because there's new regulations, and we always try to keep our viewers up to date. But Jagmeet Singh, always a pleasure to have you on the program. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
I want to take you to Regina because the Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe has just released a three-step plan to reopen the province. We haven't seen that, and relax public health restrictions, which is interesting. Check this out.
Based on the current rate of vaccinations, the province should enter step one sometime in the last week of May. Step two, likely in about the third week of June. And step three will be in early to mid-July. I know that some will say that we are moving too slow on this reopening roadmap, while others will say that we maybe are moving too fast. And to those who would like us to go faster, I would say that we do need to be cautious. While our case numbers and our hospitalizations have been stable or even declining slightly over the course of the past few weeks, both down about 20% from their peak in April, we do need to wait just a few more weeks so that more people are able to access their vaccine before we start lifting current restrictions. To those that may say we are going too fast, I would point to other countries who are further ahead of us in vaccinations and have been safely and successfully moving through their reopening plans, which are very close to what we have here today. In particular, I would point to the United Kingdom, who will soon be moving into step three of their reopening plan. They expect to lift all remaining public health orders by June the 21st. The UK began step one of its reopening on March the 8th, and on that day, they had 43% of their adult population had received their first dose of the vaccine. That's roughly where we are here today, with 44% of Saskatchewan people having received one vaccine dose. Case numbers and hospitalizations have continued to decline in the UK as they have carefully moved through the stages of their reopening plan. And I believe we can do the same here. But it's going to depend on more people getting vaccinated when it's your turn. So just to be clear, we are not stopping or in any way slowing down our vaccination plan once we reach the various thresholds that we have put forward as we start moving through these three steps that are before us. If anything, our vaccination plan is going to increase in its pace in the weeks ahead. And once everyone in Saskatchewan has had a chance to get their first dose, we are immediately going to start with second vaccination doses. We need everyone to go back and get your second dose, so that you will be fully vaccinated. I know there are still people who are...
Well, there it is. So that is the three-step plan to lift restrictions beginning in May in Saskatchewan. That's Premier Scott Moe. So, you know, some places are going, like later tonight, Alberta's going to be locked down for longer time. New restrictions there. Plans to reopen. So you see how this is so asymmetric across the country. We got to take a quick break, though, when we return Canada's COVID hotspot. Check this out as we go to Alberta.
We do something big and bold. We're not going to get on top of this exponential growth.
Alberta Premier Jason Kenney is warning new restrictions need to come as cases there surge, the highest per capita rate in North America. We're going to bring in the mayor of one of the key hotspots in a minute. We'll be right back. Is there a place in this country that's been tested more toughly than Fort Mac? 5 years after the wildfire scorched the town of Fort McMurray, Alberta, the oil town is facing another crisis, as if the crash of the price of oil is not a crisis. It's now a COVID-19 hotspot. Not only is Alberta as a province leading the country, it's leading the U.S. in per capita COVID-19 cases, but the municipality of Wood Buffalo, which encompasses Fort McMurray, has the highest per capita rate of active cases in Alberta That means in North America, with Alberta Premier Jason Kenney set to impose more public health restrictions later tonight. The federal government is offering to send the military to help. What needs to happen in Fort Mac and in Wood Buffalo to get this third wave under control? We're going to ask Don Scott. He's the mayor of the regional municipality of Wood Buffalo right now. Mayor Scott, first of all, man, you guys have been tested over the last 5 years in ways I just don't think I've ever remembered. It's one thing after another. Just give us a sense of how bad it is right there before we get what happens.
And thanks for having me. We want to return to normal. We want to get back to being, not only Alberta's economic engine, but Canada's economic engine. And the way to do that is we see that our economic future is linked to tackling this virus. So we want all the help we can get. And that's what I've been expressing to every level of government that will listen. Give us all the help you can. We're not sure about what's driving the numbers in this region. That's been one of the big problems. I mentioned that to other levels of government. They have the health information, and they're going to make decisions, but we are the receivers of the decisions, and we're just looking for help. We want to move on through this like every other place in the world eventually it does.
The military has been set to arrive in places like Ontario, Nova Scotia. What about Wood Buffalo?
Yeah, they've talked to me from the federal government and indicated that there's potential military assistance. It has to be requested by our premier. And the potential assistance, I understand, would include doctors and nurses and whatever comes with that to assist with tents and other help. Just to give you some more background, I talked to the hospital just yesterday, and I've been in regular contact with them. They tell me they're busy but managing. So we'll see as we go forward whether that kind of help is going to be necessary, but I would certainly hope.
But so you don't, just to be clear, Mayor Scott, you're not asking Premier Kenney, you haven't said, hey, don't delay, don't wait for this thing to get worse, get me some support right now. Have you asked Jason Kenney? Just, I'll take whatever help I can get. They've offered the military, take it.
You know what? I think if we've got help that's being offered and the modeling shows that it's necessary, then take it. That would be my advice to the premier or anyone else that'll listen. It depends on what the modeling says, and we've never been shown that. We have never been shown what's driving the cases. We've never been shown what the future holds for this region. I don't think it's the same in every region because we have a very different region than everywhere else. But, we want people to be healthy in this region. We want to protect their health. And ultimately, that's going to get everybody back working again, which I think is what everybody wants.
So why... Mayor, that's curious to me. Why wouldn't you be showing the modeling? Like, how do you take the right measures to stop it if you don't have the data to know what's driving it? That's kind of weird. Why aren't they sharing the data with you?
I do not know the number of people in the hospital with COVID-19 as of this moment. We've been talking to other levels of government about this issue for over 6 months now. We've been telling them, look, there is a serious problem going on up here. You need to share data with us. And just this week, they indicated that they were going to start from the province and AHS, that's our health authority, sharing data with us. But to my knowledge, it hasn't been done yet. But we're looking forward to getting that data.
It seems like it's a little late. Like, to be fair, given the case count, you're the highest per capita case count in North America, and they still don't have the data. How do you fight something that you don't have a... I'm a little gobsmacked that you don't even have the information needed to fight the enemy here. It sounds like you need to have a sit-down with the premier and get some stuff pretty squared away.
It's really every level of government. If they could get us the help we need, then I think we could start tackling this issue. The economy depends on health, and we know that, and we want to be there for all of Canada. The Indigenous people have a historical memory of what happened to them 100 years ago, and they've been at the forefront of advocacy for this region, and they are continuing to do that. That's one of the reasons that we declared a state of emergency, and we were the first in Alberta, I think, to declare a state of emergency last Sunday. So we have been signaling to every level of government, get us the help, tell us the information, and then if there's steps we can take as a municipality, if we have the information as to what will, we don't want to be indiscriminate, but we want to hit this thing with a particular weapon that's going to work.
Yeah. So Mayor, I, I, So you've asked for the data and they haven't been given it.
I understand it's coming this week, but to my knowledge, no one on mayor or council, certainly myself, I have not seen it yet. And it's frustrating.
So now tonight, Mayor, I guess the premier is going to impose more public health restrictions in the province. Do you think this is coming too late?
You know, I'm grateful for the steps that have been taken. Earlier this week, we met with the government of Alberta, the Minister of Health, and we said, please take some steps in this region. And we gave them a big list. We said, open up the age of eligibility and get more vaccines in this region. And he did both of those things within a very short time. So today they lowered the age to age 18 and they're giving us more vaccines. I think 20,000 is the number between us and Banff. So they are getting more vaccines here. So they are listening. And we don't know what additional measures are going to come into place. But I just hope that they're considering measures that will actually make a difference, not indiscriminate measures.
Okay, just quickly, what would you like to see? By the way, I know you're getting more vaccines, which is good. You can't vaccinate your way out of this right now, as you know. I mean, that's a longer-term strategy. But would you accept a curfew?
You know, the problem is we don't have the information. We don't know what's going to make a difference. The premier's made statements about camps being a driver. We do have a lot of camps in this region, but we do not know what's driving the issue. We do have Indigenous folks, not all, but some, who've indicated that that might make sense. And some of our Indigenous communities and groups have got a curfew in place. So there is different steps that might make sense. But I think unless we have the data, really the data is in the hands of the health authorities, I think they're the ones who would be best advised to say this is going to make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, this is a premier who said, more restrictions won't help, and now he's changed. Now more restrictions are coming tonight. But just what you've revealed to us tonight, Mayor Don Scott, the regional municipality of Wood Buffalo, that you've asked for the data and you just can't get the basic data to fight this. And we hope you get it. It's kind of stunning to me, but I really appreciate your candor. Good luck. I don't know if there's a more resilient group of people than the people of Wood Buffalo who've withstood so many things in the last 5 years. So we're with you and take care, sir. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks to every Canadian who stands by us. We're deeply grateful for it.
Yeah, and we all do. We're all in this thing together, but you're really in it right now. Thank you, sir. Okay, by the way, you can watch Alberta Premier Jason Kenney's announcement tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Mountain, right here on CTV News Channel and online at ctvnews.ca. So we're really keen to see what new measures the premier will take. And someone's got to ask him why he's not sharing data with the mayor of the hot zone. Coming up, mixed messages from serious public health consequences. Did the National Advisory Committee on Immunization harm Canada's inoculation effort? Again, we're going to bring back Dr. Abdu Sharkawi and the press gallery to talk about that. Stay with us.
On a personal level, I am extremely pleased that I got the AstraZeneca vaccine a number of weeks ago. It was extremely important to me to be able to protect my loved ones, to protect my family, and to do my part to ensure that all Canadians get through this as quickly as possible. The reality is the way we get through this pandemic is to get vaccinated with whatever vaccine is offered to us as quickly as possible.
Well, there was some vaccine damage control, because that's the prime minister saying how pleased he was in getting the AstraZeneca shot. He told reporters this after the fallout from the NASI chair, Dr. Caroline Quash, told Canadians and on this program last night that they can wait for an mRNA vaccine like Pfizer or Moderna than they should, depending on the risk and where they live. So was this damage control needed? Should there be a consistent vaccine messaging from Health Canada and the Independent Vaccine Advisory Board? Let's bring in the press gallery to weigh in. Bob Fife from the Globe and Mail. The Ottawa Bureau Chief joins us. Emily Nicola, the columnist with Le Devoir, is here. And we're going to bring back Dr. Abdu Sharkawi, our CTV News infectious disease specialist, because I want him to have another go around. I'm going to go Bob and then Emily and then back to the doc who was on earlier with Dr. Bogosh. Bob, what do you make of this, the mixed message and the fact that the Prime Minister and Dr. Theresa Tam, they were kind of bombarded today with messages about vaccines when you got 1.5 million Canadians who have got AstraZeneca, and suddenly they're like, wait, is that the right choice or not? Should I have waited?
Well, look, that was a terrible public relations fiasco that happened yesterday when the members of the advisory council came out and said, you know, if you can avoid having AstraZeneca, go for Pfizer or Moderna. That is not only going to making people who have had AstraZeneca very concerned, but also it's going to probably lead to vaccination hesitancy. You know, just look what happened in the United States, Evan. When they pulled Johnson & Johnson, there was a drop in the number of people, particularly amongst women, getting vaccinations. And that trend is still going on as a result of that. And you're probably going to see something very similar. Good on the Prime Minister for coming out and trying to repair the damage done. But I think it's going to take a considerable period of time because I think a lot of people are not going to want to take the AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson when they should.
Yeah, Emily, I'm very intrigued. 1.5 million Canadians, many of them the so-called Gen X, the under 45s or under 55s and under 50s. Yeah. They've got it. What do you make about that?
I think when you've got it and you haven't had the side effects, I think you're good. So I don't think it's necessarily going to make people who already got the vaccine worried because if, yeah, statistics were to show up, it would be something else. However, I think the big communication mistake there is to imply basically that if you're at higher risk because of the communities you're in, if you're in a hot spot in Ontario, in the Peel region, whatnot, then AstraZeneca is good for you or is good enough for you. And so it creates this kind of implicit messaging that basically we know where COVID has been circulating the most, right, in the last couple of weeks. So it's mostly, you know, more poor and racialized communities. And so it's like, you think that vaccine is good enough for you, and then people who are more in more affluent neighborhoods can wait for the Pfizer and the Moderna and the fancier vaccines. And yeah. So that's why ethically there was such a big mistake, because there's a history as well of making calls like that are very much ethically wrong and discriminatory in public health crisis in the last decade. This is also a huge mistake because of that. Once again, good on the Prime Minister on trying to fix that mistakes. But I think we need to name why it was wrong and what is it that it implied if we want to actually apologize for that mistake.
Yeah, and Doctor, I agree there's science about efficacy or there's legitimate concerns about rates of thrombosis / blood clots. But I thought, Dr. Sarkar, you made a powerful point picking up on what Emily just said, which I think is so critical, about this term now, preferred vaccines. Like there's now a first class and a second class, according to NACI. And is that helpful in the midst of a third wave?
No, it's very unhelpful, frankly. And we have to remind ourselves when we take the psychological pulse of the nation, this is an unprecedented pandemic in terms of what we're seeing with vaccine development in record time. We've just gotten to the point where we're trying to establish the fact that these vaccines were developed the right way, that there weren't shortcuts taken. And right. We have to remember that that background exists so that when we share information about proportional risk, we understand that it's going to evoke a response that may be disproportionately fearful. And I think that was the nuance that was not really appreciated when the messaging came out yesterday. The words really carry a ton of weight. And I don't think that that was understood and acknowledged carefully enough. And I do think people who've received the first shot of AstraZeneca are concerned about what lies ahead for them. I think they've lost an enormous amount of trust in the messaging that they've received.
Right.
And now we've got to double back and really try and put things into context for people very honestly, but very realistically. The reality is COVID continues to ravage our ICUs, our hospitals. Look at what's happening in Alberta. We can't afford to have the nuances of a proportional risk that doesn't apply to most of our population get in the way of people's habits and their preparedness to protect themselves and everyone in their community here.
Bob, and Emily, just real quick on another topic, but related. Foreign Affairs Minister Mark Garneau traveled to the UK for a G7 meeting of foreign and development ministers. He plans to quarantine in an isolation hotel after his return. Is it the right message to send to Canadians who are told, avoid travel if you can? Why is he going there?
Well, the G7 is an important, they want to actually have the prime minister at the G7 in June. So I don't have a problem with the minister going to London and traveling to do his job. He's doing the right thing when he comes back, and he's going to isolate and stay in a hotel for 3 days and isolate for 2 weeks. He's got an important job in meeting with other world foreign ministers to deal with things like COVID, but also a whole range of other international issues. So I don't really have a problem with that.
All right, I'm going to leave it there, and we're going to come back. I know Emily and Bob are going to stick around. I'll start with you next. Emily, Dr. Sharkawi, who's done double duty today. I don't know, he's done triple duty with the work he's done trying to save people's lives. Thanks, Doc. Emily and Bob, stick around. When we come back, we got the Liberals. Are they about to do a 180 on the Broadcasting Act legislation that's been so controversial? The Heritage Minister says an amendment is going to make it crystal clear. Finally, maybe, I don't know, the user-generated content isn't broadcast programming and won't be run by the CRTC. Is that enough? We got a special guest coming up to talk about that with Bob and Emily. So is the Liberal government about to walk back a divisive update on the Broadcasting Act? Well, the Heritage Minister, Stephen Guilbeault's office, says an amendment is going to clarify this, that user-generated content, the stuff you post on Facebook or TikTok or Instagram, won't be regulated by the CRTC like Netflix or Amazon. Take a look at this. The minister says we also want to make sure that the content that people upload on social media won't be considered as programming under the act and that it won't be regulated by the CRTC. And that's why we will be bringing forward another amendment that will make this crystal clear. Now, user-generated social media content was initially protected in an update to the Broadcasting Act. Then the government removed a key section that experts said, whoa, now suddenly it's vulnerable for regulation. That removal sparked a partisan outcry. Critics flagged concerns over freedom of expression. Does this latest turn in the saga calm the fears? Let's find out. The press gallery's back. The Ottawa bureau chief for the Globe and Mail, Bob Fyfe, is back. Emily Nicola, columnist with Le Devoir and the Gazette's back. And our special guest is Michael Geist, a professor at the University of Ottawa who follows us maybe closer than anyone in the country. Good to have you on. Michael Geist, your reaction to the news that there's an amendment, does this reassure your concerns that they won't be regulating user-generated content?
No, I don't think it provides a lot of reassurance at this stage. For one thing, the minister spent almost a week saying that there was nothing to see here, that he wasn't regulating. And suddenly now we have what is basically a tacit acknowledgement that that's exactly what they were doing. And so we've got a real backtracking on that front. But if they were really serious about it, they'd simply reinsert the exception that they put in the first place. But that it doesn't sound like that's what they have in mind. Instead, it sounds like they're going to try to find some ways to carve some of this out, but perhaps leave some of the regulations still intact. In a sense, trying to have their cake and eat it too, wanting to say that, well, we're trying to exempt at least some of the regulation. But at the end of the day, if you're still going to subject some of user-generated content to the prospect of CRTC regulation, that's where the concern lies. And it sounds like to me that unless they're doing a full pullback, that's what we'll still have in place.
Yeah, Emily, it's so weird. There was an exemption in the working legislation. The Liberals removed the exemption saying it's not necessary. Now they're saying, okay, it wasn't necessary, but we're going to put in another exemption. What do you make of all this and why this is so important to the average person?
I think there's a huge issue of communication because we're basically doing an amendment in a bill where there's a whole lot of issues that are incredibly complicated. That bill is part of one piece, basically, of a project that involves acting as well on online hate, as acting as well on copyright. The intent of the bill is also to basically just protect the cultural industry in Canada. And so we don't have that vocabulary clearly outlined in terms of what are the connections between what's the vocabulary in the bill and what are the intent and what are the consequences and what might be the unintended consequences. And so as long as that's not clear, you might amend as much as you want. But the conservatives, if they want to do, you know, really partisan attacks on that, because people don't have the facts, it will be hard for people who are listening to those ads to see whether or not that's legitimate. And for people who are actually caring a lot about the cultural industry, this is why actually in Quebec, this is a non-issue. You have the Bloc Québécois, the NDP, that were already comfortable with the bill as it stands. These are not people necessarily who are against freedom of expression, right? And so when you're seeing that kind of thing, basically it's hard for, I think, the layperson to understand what is it that's actually stayed behind, besides people basically just blowing fears and trying to have this inflated rhetoric around the bill.
Yeah, Bob, I guess the original intent of the bill was to kind of aim at making the web giants like Google and Facebook pay for Canadian content like a broadcaster. Did they overreach in the regulation, and what do you make of this?
Well, first of all, I want to hats off to Michael Gast, who actually highlighted this, and because this would have probably gotten through the committee if he hadn't made a stink about it, and it got the and everybody sort of woke up to what was going on. We'll find out when they table amendments on Friday. I like the approach of the NDP right now, which is to hit a 10-day pause on clause by clause so that they can have the Minister of Justice appear to make sure that this is charter proof. And secondly, to have the what is now looking like an incompetent heritage minister appear and try to explain this bill that he has not been able to explain very well. So I hope that on Friday we'll see positive changes to the legislation, and that we'll have a 10-day pause so that people can actually hear from the two ministers, and then we go through the clause by clause amendments to the legislation.
Michael Geis, I'll give you 20 seconds just to what is the thing you're looking for to see in the amendment?
Yeah, no, I agree with Bob that I think that putting a pause, doing a review, a charter review, and hearing from the ministers is right. But respectfully, I would say I don't think there's a lot of confusion here. This isn't the online hate bill. This isn't copyright. The reason you're seeing this resonate is because it is very clear this is regulating the speech of millions of Canadians. And people may be comfortable with some regulation of tech companies, but they're not comfortable with this kind of overreach.
All right, Michael Geist, I got to leave it there. Emily Nicola, Bob Fife, man, this is interesting. So we got our eyes closely on that contentious issue. Great to have the three of you on. And thank you for spending time with us and being involved in the conversations and debates and politics. That is your Power Play Day in politics. Hug your loved ones. See you tomorrow.